Well, good morning. Val, I just want to thank you for that prayer. There you are. And just want to let you know, as we've already mentioned, that on Thursday we're going to be doing a Dwell evening of prayer. And the focus of that prayer is going to be praying over the fall before us in our city, in our church, and ministry. And we're also going to give an extended time to pray for anyone who wants to receive it. So if you'd like to come and just receive prayer, we do encourage you to come to Dwell on Thursday night. We're going to continue our series in Ecclesiastes, and we're going to continue our journey of life under the sun, the exploration of what makes it meaningful with a teacher. So take your Bible and turn with me to Ecclesiastes 4. I'm going to read from chapter 4 and then over to 5, verse 8. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter. Power is on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declare that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is the one who has not yet been, who has not yet seen the evil that is done under the sun. Now over to 5 verse 8. If you see the poor oppressed in a district, and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Those who love money never have enough. Those who love wealth are never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except to feast their eyes on them? The sleep of laborers is sweet, whether they eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich permits them no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when they have children, there's nothing left for them to inherit. Everyone comes naked from the mother's womb. And as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from their toil that they can carry in their hands. This, too, is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And do what do they gain, since they toil for the wind? All their days they eat in darkness, with great frustration, affliction, and anger. Nice to end on that sobering note from the teacher in Ecclesiastes. I want to begin this morning by talking about coffee. In fact, if you had a coffee this morning, this is a story about what you just drank. About 6 years ago, I was involved, along with a number of people and other churches, in a coffee project that directly imported and bought coffee from Honduran farmers so that we could support families and communities in remote parts of Honduras. And I learned a lot about the coffee project when I had the opportunity to sit down with four farmers who were growing this coffee. And they explained to me what life was like for them, but also almost every coffee farmer in that area and the whole system of coffee production in Honduras. This is their summary, and I'm giving you a very short summary of how it works in Honduras with coffee. Almost every coffee farmer is very poor. Very few of them own a vehicle, which is a very important part of the story. You see, when it comes time to pick their crop and bag all the beans, they are dependent on people who work for the larger companies, often in partnership with North America, to come with vans or trucks and buy their coffee from them and bring it back. Those who come also negotiate the price, and they also bring guns for the negotiation. So you can imagine how much the coffee farmers sell their coffee for. Virtually nothing. And if they don't sell it, they can't even buy the beans to crop to do another crop the next year. The beans then get sorted, and they're shipped off to North American coffee companies, who then roast it and sell it very competitively and enough to make a handsome profit themselves. That's how the coffee system works in Honduras and in North America. Now, as I sat there listening to these farmers tell me the story, I felt anger. I felt the frustration of these men who work so hard to get good coffee and get almost nothing for it. But I also felt complicit. Because for most of my life, if I was going to buy coffee, I would get the biggest tin of the cheapest coffee I could find made by these particular coffee companies. So I was part of the story. And I'm told, at least as I listen to others, that this same system operates with so many different areas of life, from chocolate to snacks to technology to clothing we wear. These unseen, hidden forms of oppression are everywhere. In this passage, the teacher examines what I might call the toxic trifecta of oppression, greed, and money. It's a terrible combination, and as the teacher looks at it, he finds it frustrating and meaningless. The teacher's already looked at the brevity of life, the inevitability of death, and now he's honing in on the fact that in those years we have to live, there is awful oppression, and injustice, and greed, and the abuse of power, and this makes life meaningless. And when I say meaningless, remember, the teacher's saying it's hard to grasp. It doesn't make sense. Why does the world have to be this way? That's the struggle of the teacher in Ecclesiastes. Now he begins on a very poignant note in chapter 4 where he says, I saw the tears of the oppressed and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of whom? The oppressor. There is no one to comfort the poor. And I declared, he says, that the dead were better off than the living. Can you just let that statement settle in for a moment? He looks at the oppression and says, it's better to be dead than to live with that kind of oppression. This isn't some small deal. This is serious oppression. And many writers, of course, are trying to figure out what kind of oppression is he witnessing. He doesn't mention the kind of oppression. And many writers are saying, well, it's probably, the book of Ecclesiastes, probably written in the 3rd century before Christ. It's probably at a time where the Greeks exercised considerable power over God's people, and they'd be sold into slavery if they couldn't pay their debts, and so this is the time, but we don't know for sure. All we know is this is awful oppression. And in chapter 5, when the teacher comes back to talk about injustice, he talks about it in almost a melancholic way. Look at what he says. When you see the poor oppressed, and justice being denied, don't be surprised. It's the way the world is. It's the way world under our sun seems to operate. The abuse of power, the use of getting personal gain from those below you. And what does he point to? Look at 5, verse 8 and 9. He points to the system. He says, one official is higher than another one, for that official has one who is still higher still, looking over those people below them. He's not pointing at one incident of oppression or someone stealing one thing from another person. He's talking about a whole system that's intricately connected and making sure that the people on the bottom fund the people on the top, and those along the way get their share of the cut. It's corruption. It's oppression. It's greed. And he's saying it's all here in this system that's connected together. And it's worth pausing and saying, how well are we doing with that today? Have we defeated the kind of corruption he's talking about that's intricately woven into systems of power, into government, into corporations? I mean, do we have any news today about scandals? Abuse of power in government? Policy that abuses the poor? No, we've solved this? I'm trying to joke with you people. I'm hoping you're seeing the connection here. And he goes right to the top. The teacher says, the increase of the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Now, there's a lot of debate about the Hebrew of these words, but I side with those who say the point of what he's saying in that verse is that the king is profiting handsomely from the land that belongs to the people under him. And if you know anything about Old Testament land laws, you'll know that this is a travesty. You see, when the people settled into the land in the Old Testament, this is a big deal when they arrive at Canaan, God's promised land of abundance for them. They had to learn a lot about land. And the first thing they would have learned is it doesn't belong to them. Doesn't belong to their clan, doesn't belong to the king. Who does it belong to? Belongs to God. And God distributes it to his people so that everyone has a chance to experience the richness of the land, a place to raise their family, a place to grow their crops, and thrive. And if you read Deuteronomy and Proverbs, you'll see very strong warnings against people who move boundary markers for land. Move the place that allocates whose is whose because it doesn't belong to them, and it's not their right to take land away from God who distributed it through his people. And that's why it's so egregious to hear that the king, who, by the way, is implemented and put in the position to protect people and protect the justice for the people who don't have as much land as others, is the very same king now who's benefiting handsomely from that land. This is a betrayal of the function of being in that position. And as the teacher looks at this whole system, he finds it so very painful. How did it become this way? This is the way the world works under the sun. The very people who are set to protect justice are abusing it and bending it and tilting the scales against the poor for their own gain. That is unfair. And it shouldn't surprise us that the next line of inquiry in the second half of chapter 5 is about money. Often the reason why all the exploitation happens. And it echoes back to chapter 1, where when the teacher looks at money, he says it's meaningless. The pursuit of wealth, finding contentment and satisfaction in this hedonistic lifestyle, it's not going to get you what you want. But he makes 5 observations about money, and I want to go through them briefly with us this morning. First, the teacher says, the love of money does not bring satisfaction. He says, those who love money never have enough. Those who love wealth are never satisfied with their income. You ever notice that? There's a very significant CEO in the States who was interviewed like 7 years ago. And he was making so much money in his industry. And the interviewer asked the question to him. They said, how much money do you want? You know what his answer was? Just a little bit more. Case in point, we are not content with our money. The love of wealth generates a deeper desire for more, and it's insatiable. That's the first point. Secondly, he says, as goods increase, so do those who consume them. Or to put it a different way, you don't seem to get to that point where you're happy. As your means increase, so do the bills. And somehow the thing you're pursuing starts pursuing you, and you're not even able to enjoy it anymore. Third, money causes worry. You ever notice that? The more you have, the more you accumulate, the more you're worried. Listen to what he says. The sleep of the laborer is sweet, whether they eat much or little, but the abundance of the rich permits them no sleep. Why would that be? They're thinking about their stuff. They're thinking about how to protect it. What if someone steals it? What if they lose it? All of a sudden, they can't sleep because they've accumulated all this, and they're not sure how to keep it all safe under their management. And I'll just pause and say that one of the most lucrative industries in the West right now, even here in Clayton Heights, you know what it is? Home security. In fact, I had someone come to my door like 3 months ago, very cleverly saying, we are with Neighborhood Watch. I'm like, oh, that's great. We have Neighborhood Watch. He says, yes, we're very concerned about the safety of this area, and we'd like to sell you the security system for $60 a month. And I'm like, oh, that's not Neighborhood Watch. That's personal security under the veil of Neighborhood Watch. But this is a lucrative industry. Why? Because we all have a lot of stuff, and we are those people who at night worry about what to do with it. That's his third point. Fourthly, the teacher points out the obvious, simple point that we forget. You can lose all your money. Listen to what he says. I've seen a grievous thing under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when they have children, there's nothing left for them to inherit. You can lose it. You can gain a lot and you can lose a lot. And I know people who've gained a lot quickly and lost it just as quickly. Sometimes it's their fault. Other times it's not even their fault. They've been embezzled. They were duped. They were brought into some system or someone's trying to get quick money off of them and they lost it. Perhaps there's some of us here this morning who've experienced the way in which money goes like this. And fifth and finally, in true teacher fashion, he says, everyone comes naked from their mother's womb. And as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from the toil that they carry in their hands. Or as Pastor Sid put it so eloquently 2 weeks ago, you never see a hearse towing a U-Haul. You can't bring it with you. So the teacher finishes in true form. All their days they eat in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. And so just to summarize how this all fits together, he starts by saying, do you see the injustice? Do you see the oppression? The scales are tilted against the poor, the people who have power, have people more powerful than them, calling the shots and forming system that exploits the poor, brings the money to the top for personal gain. That's the first thing. Secondly, he says, not only is the system unjust, but the people operating it and those who have power, political, economic power, won't even be satisfied with what it's bringing them, which is money. It's a double frustration. The poor are oppressed, and that's not just, and those who get the money from it are not going to be happy as they get the money. That's a big question. And he's putting it in front of us because he wants us to grapple with it. He wants the reader to say, how do you make sense of life if this is the world in which we live? What answer do you give to this problem? How do you solve the dilemma of corruption, injustice, oppression, and greed, and the fact that none of it, on any level, will bring satisfaction to anyone involved? Now, if someone came to you and say, how do you answer that question as a Christian? What would you say? Now, like so many passages in Ecclesiastes, this one just sits there. There's no bow tie at the end of every verse, and as I've said in almost every sermon along this series, Ecclesiastes finds its resolution in verse or chapter 12 at the end and in the wider biblical story. And what does he say at the very end of this book? I want us to remember this forever. Now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of all mankind. For God is the judge of every deed, that which is seen and unseen. And I want us to pause and ask the question, okay, how does that statement resolve the reality of injustice, greed, oppression, and the meaninglessness of money? Fear God, keep his commandments, God is the judge. Well, I'll just indicate briefly, and I'll probably come back to this, that the way in which God being the judge is a really important piece. Throughout the Old Testament, you see all the injustice being brought to God, and the psalmists especially say, God, you see this, you're the judge, we bring this into your hands, we will not enact violence against what has been done, but we're trusting that you're the judge. It's a big piece of Old Testament teaching. But secondly, God's character is called into here. Fear God. Fear his character. Well, what kind of character is this writer giving us? And if you've read the Bible, you'll realize from the beginning to the end, the character of the Father is one who identifies with and cares deeply for the oppressed. He cares deeply for the marginalized, for those who are taken advantage of and exploited. This is a God who comes near to them and lifts them up. God sees all the oppression and sides with those who are exploited. Do you see that in the scriptures? Old and new, beginning to end. When God calls a man to himself to bless the nations through, he's a senior. This is not a man in the prime of his life with lots of power. He's a senior. When God calls a nation to himself as his treasured possession through whom he's going to bring that blessing, what kind of nation is it? The slave nation. They're in oppression, crying out for someone to take them and care for them and rescue them. And God takes Israel, this little slave nation, to be his own. This is how God operates. And you'll see in both the law and the prophets over and over and over again, they call on his character as they say, this is how you are to live. You must protect the poor. You must care for them because the God you serve and you worship is a father to the fatherless. He lifts up the needy and crowns them with authority. He cares for the ones who are vulnerable, orphans, and widows. That's the God we worship. And anytime that's forgotten, the prophets come in and say, didn't you hear us? You should hear the prophet Amos, who he's coming into the wealthy religious leaders, the priests of the day. They have lots of power. They've got a good thing going on. It looks really good. And you know what he says to them? I hate hearing your worship. I hate hearing your voices singing. I can't stand the sacrifices you bring to my temple. The worship I want is what? Justice and mercy and care for the oppressed. And Amos is speaking on behalf of the Father who's saying, you've forgotten who I am. And you've forgotten who's all created in my image. This is important stuff for the character of the Father. And no one says it better, of course, than Jesus himself. In Matthew 18, the parable of the sheep and the goats, where he comes in glory and judgment and power, and he's separating the sheep from the goats, the faithful from the unfaithful. What's the criterion Jesus himself speaks with? He says, I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. And they said to Jesus, Lord, when did we do this for you? And the zinger comes when he says, whatever you did for the least of my brothers, you did for me. And the real sting comes when it's all reversed. You're out of my kingdom because you did not care. You did not see. You did not help. You did not get involved. You did not visit. You did not open your homes. The very God who identifies and cares for and protects the weak and vulnerable shows up in the middle of history not in a palace, but in a barn. When his parents went to the temple to give an offering, they gave the smallest offering, which is an indication of their social economic status. They're poor. We're told that Jesus had no home to live in, no place to rest his head. Much of his time was spent not with powerful people, but poor people. Breaking bread not with the elites, but with the outcasts. Forgiving and healing the lepers. Dining with the prostitutes and the tax collectors. And people look at him and say, what's wrong with him? And Jesus says, this is the kingdom of God. This is the people. These are the people I invite to share bread around my table. This is what it looks like when the kingdom shows up. Jesus himself was oppressed, unjustly accused, flogged by people in power, and he identified with all those who had gone before him in just the same way. As one person puts it, Jesus didn't just suffer for the oppressed. He suffered with and as the oppressed. Not that long ago, I read a story of a young African-American woman who was in university. She had grown up in the Christian faith. She knew the Bible stories, and as so many young adults do, she was struggling with what to make of her faith in this big secular institution of the university. And as she was grappling, she happened to take a course on the history of Christianity, taught not by a Christian. This was just taught as sort of part of history. This is what was part of the Western background, the Western history. And so she listened to this professor talk about the history of Christianity, and he got to teaching about the cross and just sort of summarizing what Christians teach about the cross. And in that moment, God revealed to her the beauty of the cross. And she later said, somehow in that class, for the first time, the cross became beautiful. And she saw the cross not just as some sort of thing that's spiritual and ethereal reality where we get pulled out of the world, but of Jesus himself, God in the flesh, entering into the suffering of humanity. Understanding and carrying on himself the weight of oppression and sin and violence and injustice. Carrying that on himself and taking that to the grave. And in that class, she realized that's what God does, and that's how God responds to the evil and the injustice and the oppression of the world we live in. You see, the teacher's ultimate struggle in this part of our passage in Ecclesiastes is injustice and oppression and pain, and everyone has to grapple with that. It doesn't matter who you talk to. That's a real question. And people will say to you, well, how can you believe in God if our world is so messed up? And part of that, by the way, it's helpful to realize everyone has to answer that question, no matter what you believe. What's your resolution to this? Do we just say, this is just the way the world is? We have to live with it. Is science and technology going to solve it for us? Is education going to solve it for us? I'm not particularly hopeful in this moment that those are the saviors of our unjust world. John Stott writes these powerful words. He says, in a world of injustice, how can you believe in a God who is immune to it? Therefore, I believe in God because of the cross. Does that make sense? He's saying it's the cross that enables us to understand the depths of God's love, who enters into the suffering, enters into the sorrow, enters into the oppression in order to bring healing and restoration and forgiveness. It's the church that displays what the cross did. It's the church that shows the world that's grappling with the same kind of injustice we do, what Jesus Christ did once and for all to deal with the problem of injustice, oppression, and pain. The church is the place where power is wielded in love. The church is the place where money is used for care. One of the most stunning dimensions of the early church is not simply how it spoke into the public arena, but what it was made up of. Who it was made up of. The church was made up of Jews, Gentiles, slaves, free, men, women, poor, wealthy, children, adults. And as people in a very stratified society like Rome would look at the church and say, why are these people sitting around the same table? What makes this kind of community possible? And the early believers would simply point to the death and the resurrection of Jesus, which shattered through the social barriers of Rome and created a whole new humanity, a whole new kind of people who called each other brothers and sisters, a socially explosive category in the Roman world. That slave is my brother. That wealthy person is my sister. We are family in Jesus Christ. You couldn't find this community anywhere else in Rome. And in their very being together, learning how to be brothers and sisters, they proclaimed the power of the cross of Jesus Christ. They showed a different way of being human, a different way of living, a different way of operating in this world of oppression, showing how it could be done and the way it will be done when Jesus comes back. That's the church. Shane Claiborne is quite well, he puts it really well in a comment where he says, throughout history, the church has grown well not by force. Force didn't go so well for the church, but they grew well when people were fascinated by their community. And the problem in his mind is that we're far less fascinating now than you might say of the first century church. Or as he puts it, we give atheists less and less to disbelieve. Does that make sense? As they look at the church, there's less and less to see and say, wow, I disagree with that. A couple weeks ago, I made some statements about what it looks like to be the church in a hedonistic culture. I want to add to that what the ministry of the church looks like in an oppressive, unjust world in which we live. The church is a community that lives in solidarity with the poor and the vulnerable in a world where there's increasing disparity between the rich and the poor. The church is a community that seeks to live justly in every area of life in a culture full of economic and social injustice, hidden and visible. The church is a community that actively stands against oppression in word and deed and does not sit quietly on the sidelines in a culture, again, where much injustice is done very quietly and behind the scenes. The church is a community of equalizing love in a culture where power is abused. It's a community of reconciliation in a culture of us and them, me and you. It's a community of selfless care in a culture of elevating the self and narcissism. Now, I don't know about you, but that's the church I want to be part of. Is that a church you want to be part of? And I'm praying that over the years, as the Spirit is at work in our own church, that people can identify these markers in our own community. As Jesus breaks our heart for injustice, as the Spirit moves us to generosity, and you've heard me say throughout the pandemic that I pray our church is not just stewardly with our money in this season, but radically generous in this season. And even the Adams Road Breakfast Program is one way where we can say, this community is for the city. And we are for children who don't go to school with a full stomach. We want to care for the kids who aren't having breakfast. That's just one way where we say, this is where the church needs to step in. This is who we are as the reconciled community in Jesus Christ that knows where the future is going. Valerie spent a bunch of time in confession, but I want to lead us in a prayer where I give time of silence where we can pray into oppression. We can pray into injustice, and I'm going to invite the Spirit to move in our community, that we'd be the kind of church that I've just described. Would you join me in prayer?